My name is Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we are going to return once again to the whole discussion of UFOs as a political issue. Now, generally, when one talks about UFOs, people will roll their eyes and view you as having a D blank, blank, blank growing out of your head. I can appreciate that. The fact of the matter is that the entire UFO question is something that should be dealt with as the important political phenomenon that it is. Just how important a political phenomenon it is was exemplified in an article in the New York Times of Saturday, June 14th of 1997. This is an article by Amy Harmon, H-A-R-M-O-N, of the New York Times. It's datelined Roswell, New Mexico, and headlined, "For UFO Buffs, 50 Years of Hazy History." And skipping down in this article, we see a section which discusses something that indicates how important the UFO phenomenon is as a political issue. Talking about the many pop UFO enthusiasts who visited Roswell, New Mexico, supposedly the site of an E.T. UFO crash in 1947, such summer merriment in the desert, where temperatures can rise to 110 degrees, is testimony to the emergence, to the emergence of a mainstream belief in UFOs. A recent Gallup poll found that 42% of American college graduates believe that flying saucers have visited Earth in some form. One more time. A recent Gallup poll found that 42% of American college graduates believe that flying saucers have visited Earth in some form. In a measure of the shift in public attitudes, a Roper Center survey 2 decades ago found that 30% of college graduates believe in UFOs. And skipping down in this particular article, the importance of the UFO phenomenon as a political phenomenon is underscored by the fact that there are indications that UFOs are real, but they don't come from outer space, and that they've been around for a long time. We read in this same article, "Like most legends, the Roswell tale traces its genesis to a real event. In early 1947, a ranch foreman, W.W. Brazel, B-R-A-Z-E-L, found strange shiny material littering the ground near Roswell in southeastern New Mexico. He turned the material over to the sheriff, who gave it to the military authorities at the air base here. On July 8th of that year, the Army Air Forces, which later that month became the Air Force, a separate service under the newly established Department of Defense, issued a news release about the landing of a, quote, flying disc, unquote. This resulted in a headline in the local newspaper, the Roswell Daily Record, that said, quote, RAAF captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region, unquote. Military authorities recanted the next day, calling the curious debris merely a downed weather balloon." So, again, there are some indications here that these things, whatever they are, have been around for quite some time, and that perhaps the fantasy of some of the pop UFO enthusiasts has a grounding in fact. In a lecture that I gave in October of 1992 entitled "The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the ET Myth," I discussed some of the history of development of circular flying machines in the Earth's atmosphere, and indeed there are indications that this began during the World War II period. We're now going to excerpt that lecture for much of the rest of the next half-hour segment.
Now, something which is far better documented than that concerns the development of circular flying machines in the Earth's atmosphere. What I'm going to talk about next concerns the actual historical record of circular flying machines that are known to have flown in Earth's atmosphere, not built by our brothers from space, but built by human beings. Now, again, I refer people to the book Intercept But Don't Shoot by Renato Vesco, again, a fellow who was in charge of research and development for the Italian Air Force, also a veteran Italian intelligencer. He goes into the historical record of some of the experiments that German aviation was engaging in during the World War II and some of the technological developments that they had achieved during the closing months of the Second World War. Any competent history of the activities of the Army, the U.S. Army U.S. 8th Army Air Force during the closing months of World War II. We'll go into what is known as the Foo Fighters or Krautballs. Foo, by the way, is a corruption of the French word for feu, fire, F-E-U. It was corrupted by American airmen to be Foo, F-O-O. A number of American planes, both bombers and interceptors, saw glowing circular objects which caused their electronics and in particular their radar to malfunction as they were on missions over Germany during the closing months of World War II. What they were witnessing, and I'm going to go into the actual development of these, was the use of a German anti-aircraft device known as the Feuerball or Fireball. Now, first I'm going to begin with a discussion by reading from Vesco's text of the so-called Krautballs or Foo Fighters. Vesco writes, in Intercept But Don't Shoot, a former flying officer who had been in the intelligence section of the 8th Air Force during the final days of the war in Europe and did not wish to be named, apparently because he was still working in some section of the U.S. Air Force, declared to the New York Press, quote, "It is quite possible that the flying saucers are the latest development of a, quote, psychological, unquote, anti-aircraft weapon that the Germans had already used. During night missions over western Germany, I happened to see on several occasions shining discs or balls that followed our formations. It was well known that the German night fighters had powerful headlights in their noses or propeller hubs, lights that would suddenly catch the target, partly in order to give the German pilots better aim, but mostly in order to blind the enemy tail gunners in their turrets. They caused frequent alarms and continual nervous tension among the crews, thereby lowering their efficiency. During the last year of the war, the Germans also sent up a number of radio-controlled bright objects to interfere with the ignition systems of our engines or the operation of the onboard radar. In all probability, American scientists picked up this invention and are now perfecting it so that it will be on a par with the new offensive and defensive air weapons," unquote. Again, that's a quote from a former intelligence officer working with the 8th Army Air Force. Vesco continues, "Then other flyers who had taken part in the opening of the Second Front also reported to the press that toward the end of the hostilities in the area between Hagenau and Alsace-Lorraine and Neustadt on der Weinstraße in the Rhine Valley, there were certain phenomena that oddly resembled the present-day reports of flying saucers. Convinced that they were faced with a new German secret weapon, the American flyers called them Foo Fighters, firefighters from the French feu, or fire, and jokingly, quote, Krautballs, unquote. Subsequently, something similar but on a far smaller scale was seen by bomber crews over the Japanese islands. Former war correspondent R. Palmer, for example, has related how one of the Foo Fighters followed an American plane over the Rhine Valley for about 18 miles. The incident began at about 10 p.m. on November 23, 1944. Lieutenant Edward Schluter, S-C-H-L-U-E-T-E-R, of the 415th U.S. Night Fighter Squadron stationed at Dijon, was flying a heavy night fighter toward Mainz. After carrying out a large-scale diversion along the northern edge of the Black Forest, the pilot began to follow the long ribbon of the Rhine. At about 20 miles from Strasbourg, Lieutenant Fred Ringwald, an Air Force intelligence officer who was taking part in the mission as an observer, glanced out the side window of the darkened cockpit and saw in the distance about 10 small balls of reddish fire flying in formation at an amazing speed. Quote, I wonder what those lights are over in the hills," Ringwald said to Schluter. "Probably stars," the pilot replied. "I don't think so. Are you sure they're not a reflection from us?" "Positive." Puzzled, the pilot looked hard at the lights, which were now coming straight toward his plane. Without further delay, he radioed the American ground radar station. Quote, "There are about 10 Heine night fighters around here in the sky. Looks as if they are chasing us and their speed is high." Quote, "You guys must be nuts. Nobody up there but yourself," replied the radar station. Now notice the radar does not detect these. Vesco has an explanation for that, which will come up in the next section I'm going to read. The next section of the book that I'm going to extract here. Continuing, the radar observer, Lieutenant Donald J. Myers, then got on the plane's radar scope to scan the fiery balls, but although the danger zone and the entire sky in the vicinity was scanned, there was no evidence of enemy aircraft. Quote, Sure, no enemy planes showed up on the screen, and yet those red lights, unquote. They continued to glow in sinister fashion a few miles off. Schluter moved toward them at full throttle. As if they had foreseen the attack, the glow of the bodies rapidly dimmed, and without changing position, after a few moments, they became completely invisible. The American plane crossed that part of the sky without encountering any moving body. More than 2 minutes went by, and the globes, glowing red as before, reappeared but somewhat farther off as though regrouping for a counterattack. Instead, 6 minutes later, after having completed a very long glide, they vanished into the night toward the German rear behind the Siegfried Line. At this point, the plane's radar began to give evidence of serious malfunctioning, and the pilot had to give up his train strafing for the night. Discussing what had happened during the flight back to the base, the flyers came to the conclusion that what they had seen were experimental devices which explained the malfunctioning of the radar on the order of the small, multicolored rockets that earlier used to be fired at German anti-aircraft batteries in order to confuse their aim during the Great Night bombing raids. Since they had not been able to identify the lights with any degree of certainty, and since the lights themselves had given no indication of aggressive intention, the flyers decided not to mention him in their flight report to the Dijon command for fear of being considered lunatics or victims of war neurosis. Now, I would note here a couple of the things which are similar to the behaviors of the, quote, UFOs which were seen over Washington. When it became apparent that they were being detected and going to be intercepted, they danced away. Note also that the flyers were hesitant to report this because they were afraid of being perceived as nuts. That's very similar to the way Jacques Vallée's compatriots reacted when they saw the UFO through the powerful telescope at the observatory. Only Vallée of the eight observers was willing to talk about it. The others were afraid that they would be professionally damaged by being perceived as nuts. Now, what Vallée goes into next concerns the actual development of the Feuerball or Fireball. Not Vallée, excuse me, Vesco. In a section that he entitles appropriately the Anti-Radar Feuerball, Vesco, again formerly in charge of research and development for the Italian Air Force, goes into the actual technological development of these. And again, one of the things that I think is excellent about this book is that it is both very readable and yet also very technologically competent. I had a tough time going through it the first time around, not being an aeronautical engineer or versed in applied or theoretical physics. I had to read many of the footnotes, some of them two paragraphs in length, several times before I was able to understand them. Now, in the section, the anti-radar Feuerball, now, again, we're talking about documented history of things that were created by human beings, not people from another planet, during the closing months of the Second World War. With the news of the third massive appearance of the flying saucers in 1950, the Foo Fighters reappeared on the scene, this time cited by ufologists as proof that Martian observers were present in the skies during the last war. Since the idea of extraterrestrial observers clashes with the most elementary horse sense, let us rummage about for a while among the German secrets of the last days of the war, with special reference to that category of secrets which, for reasons of military expedience, even today preserves in whole or in part its shadowy and malefic character. In the autumn of 1944 in Oberammergau in Bavaria, the OBF, an experimental center run by the Luftwaffe, had completed a series of researches into electrical apparatuses capable of interfering with the operation of an engine up to a maximum distance of about 100 feet by producing intense electromagnetic fields. If the ignition of a plane's engine could be short-circuited, the plane would be bound to crash. In order to make the invention a practical proposition, the German technicians proposed to at least triple the radius of action of this weapon, but when the conflict ended, researches along those lines had been barely sketched out. In the meantime, as a byproduct of these researches that could be put to immediate use in the war, another center, run by Speer and the SS Technical General Staff, had adopted the idea of, quote, of employing, quote, proximity radio interference, unquote, on the very much more delicate and hence more vulnerable electronic apparatuses of the American night fighters. Thus, a highly original flying machine was born. It was circular and armored, more or less resembling the shell of a tortoise, and was powered by a special turbojet engine, also flat and circular, whose principles of operation recalled the well-known allopile of Hero, which generated a great halo of luminous flames. Again, the description, as Vesco says, thus a highly original flying machine was born. It was circular and armored, more or less resembling the shell of a tortoise, and was powered by a special turbojet engine, also flat and circular, whose principles of operation recalled the well-known allopile of Hero, which generated a great halo of luminous flames. Hence, it was named Feuerball or Fireball. It was unarmed and pilotless. Radio controlled at the moment of takeoff, it then automatically followed enemy aircraft, attracted by their exhaust flames, and approached close enough without collision to wreck their radar gear. The fiery halo around its perimeter, caused by a very rich fuel mixture and the chemical additives that interrupted the flow of electricity by over-ionizing the atmosphere in the vicinity of the plane, generally around the wingtips or tail surfaces, subjected the H2S radar on the plane to the action of powerful electrostatic fields and electromagnetic impulses, the latter generated by large klystron radio tubes protected with special anti-shock and anti-heat armor. Since a metal carrying an oscillating current of the proper frequency, equal, that is, to the frequency used by the radar station, can cancel the blips, return signals from the target, the Feuerball was almost undetectable by the most powerful American radar of the time, despite its nighttime visibility. In addition, the builders of the device hoped, and their hopes were fulfilled, that when the Allied fighters, not knowing their nature or purpose, noticed that the fiery balls were apparently harmless, they would not fire on those enormous-looking, because of their large halos of fire, quote, inoffensive, unquote, devices, for fear of being caught in some gigantic explosion. More than once, in fact, as they fearfully watched those huge lights close in, the American pilots thought that some German technician on the ground was perhaps getting ready to push a button and cause the Foo Fighters to explode. Project Feuerball was first constructed at the aeronautical establishment at Wiener Neustadt with the help of the Flugfunk Forschungsanstalt of Oberpfaffenhofen, or FFO, insofar as radio control of the missile was concerned, but was it really a missile? One person, this is very important, one person who saw the first short test flights of the device without its electrical gear says that, quote, during the day, it looked like a shining disc spinning on its axis, and during the night, it looked like a burning globe, unquote. Again, quote, during the day, it looked like a shining disc spinning on its axis, and during the night, it looked like a burning globe, unquote. Hermann Göring inspected the progress of the work a number of times, for he hoped, as in fact it happened, that the mechanical principle could later also be used to produce an offensive weapon capable of revolutionizing the whole field of aerial warfare. When the Russians began to press on toward Austria, the construction of the first fireballs was apparently continued by a number of underground plants in the Schwarzwald that were run by the Zeppelinwerke. The klystron tubes were supplied by the section of Forschungsanstalt der Deutschen Reichspost, or FDRP, of Ach bei Ratzelfell on Lake Constance, and later also by the FDRP section of Galeberg, whose products, however, were not as perfect as those delivered by the FDRP, a fact that caused a number of fireballs to be used simultaneously in formation. Now, again, we're not talking about science fiction. We're not talking about theoretical concepts. We're talking about historical development, and we're talking about machines which were flying in the Earth's atmosphere almost a half a century ago. And just think of what may have been developed in the half century since. That's something I'm going to go into in just a minute. Now, the next thing that I'm going to go into here, again, relying on Vesco's text, concerns the development of the Kugelblitz, or ball lightning. Now, the Kugelblitz was a machine which was developed. It represented what Hermann Göring had hoped to develop. Hermann Göring, of course, the former chief of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, during World War II. He had hoped that the same basic principle could be applied to an offensive weapon, and in fact, one was developed, something called the Kugelblitz, or ball lightning. That was only used once or twice in combat. The descriptions of those provided by Vesco as follows. Quote, in a chapter, chapter 5, called Revolutionary German Anti-Aircraft Weaponry, we find the following. Quote, The circular German fighter without wings or rudder suddenly overtook the four-engine Liberator, crossing its flight path at very high speed. When it passed in front of the formation, it gave off a number of little bluish clouds of smoke. A moment later, the American bombers mysteriously caught fire, exploding in the air while the German, quote, rocket had already disappeared over the horizon. And again, he begins, this eyewitness, a German, an Allied intelligence observer, the circular German fighter without wings or rudder suddenly overtook the four-engine Liberator, crossing its flight path at very high speed. And Vesco goes on after that paragraph, This astonishing combat, if it can be called that, between the very latest type of interceptor and a group of flying fortresses that had detached themselves from the main group and were heading toward southern Bavaria, took place within a matter of seconds in the sky over Württemberg. The date is unspecified, but it must have been around the end of March or the beginning of April 1945. A sketchy account of the event had been included in a report on the latest developments of the German anti-aircraft industry written by a Gaullist French diplomat living in Switzerland. This report, together with other restricted documents, was destined for the intelligence service of the General Headquarters in Algiers and was clearly the work of an informer operating on the German side of Lake Constance. In the same report, there were even a mention of certain, quote, methane anti-aircraft bombs, unquote, that the Germans had experimented with on Lake Garda against another formation of flying fortresses, with results about the same as those of the first. Intercepted by Italian agents, the report was deciphered by the SID, the Servizio Informazioni Difeso, the Defense Intelligence Service, in Castiglione del Stivieri, while the Allies were pushing to break through the Po Valley defenses. Shortly afterwards, it made up part of the loot seized by intelligence service agents following the British 8th Army. The event was not completely unknown to the Allied investigators. When Dr. Goebbels attempted to allay the fears caused by the terrible bombardment of Dresden by resuming his propaganda campaign, promising that powerful and still unknown anti-aircraft weapons would soon be in use, both the intelligence service and the OSS managed to obtain a short report of a test made with a sort of weapon that could perhaps explain the mysterious disappearance of a dozen four-engine American planes during their flight into Germany from a British base. This report, which also seemed to come from an informer in Switzerland, reported in fact that, quote, a strange flying machine, hemispherical or at any rate circular in shape, attacked them at a fantastic speed, destroying them in a few seconds without using any guns. Again, this report quoted, a strange flying machine, hemispherical, or at any rate circular in shape, attacked them at a fantastic speed, destroying them in a few seconds without using any guns, unquote. Now, this weapon obviously was only used a few times. One of the things that Vesco does, and that is really excellent, is he goes into the development of a number of different German technologies during the closing years of World War II. And what apparently this Kugelblitz used as a weapon was a form of liquefied methane or fire damp that's often found in coal mines. Basically, it flew out in front of the bombers, released puffs of liquefied methane, which, when they hit the spark plugs of the engines of the bombers, obviously it ignited and caused the planes to explode. And he goes into the development of so-called blower cannons and the use of methane bombs and things of that kind. Now, again, what we're talking about is the historical record of circular flying machines, a long way, no doubt, from the current technologies being employed, but circular flying machines, not built by things from another world, but built by human beings right here on this one almost a half century ago. Now, Vesco goes on to describe other experiments being conducted by the British as well as the Americans during the British as well as the Germans during World War II. And one of the things that he goes into is the development of so-called suction wing aircraft. And he makes an excellent case that, in fact, in all probability, suction wing aircraft were developed into the first real so-called flying saucers. And again, not developed by creatures from another world, but developed by creatures from this world and developed a long time ago. One of the things that Vesco goes into is the development, again, of the suction wing aircraft in relation to conquering the boundary layer. Now, the boundary layer is that layer of any medium which impinges directly on an object moving through it. When you're driving a car, virtually all of the gas that you give your car over 40 miles an hour is used to overcome the wind resistance to your car. You've no doubt seen the 18-wheelers with those airfoils over the cab. That may look sort of funny, but in fact, on a long-distance haul, having that airfoil, which greatly reduces the atmospheric drag on the 18-wheeler, adds significantly to the fuel economy and consequently to the profits of the trucking firm or individual if it's an independent, and that's why you see those things on the trucks. Now, in the 1930s, aeronautical engineers both in Britain and in Germany were working on conquering the so-called boundary layer. And one of the things that they had come up with was the idea of the quote, blowing, unquote, the boundary layer, or basically sucking it in. They began experimenting with what were known as suction wings. They discovered that the boundary layer was easiest to control in the area around the wing of an aircraft. So at first they began experimenting with aircraft wings with perforations along the leading edge of the wing to suck in the boundary layer, again that layer of the air impinging directly on the wing, as it was being formed. Later they began experimenting with something called Luftschwamm, or literally air sponge or flight sponge. What this involved was a process called sintering. Basically, pieces of metal were stuck together with a rosin, heated till they fused together to form basically what was a metallic sponge. Although apparently solid, in fact, it was an aeropermeable metallic surface, in some ways similar to the ball on a ballpoint pen. What Vesco talks about is the experiments that were conducted both by the British and the Germans, and he develops a very credible hypothesis from both some of the eyewitness accounts of the so-called UFOs and from the development of suction-winged aircraft, that what ultimately was developed was a type of flying wing. Now, people have no doubt seen frisbees thrown about. Everybody has played with a frisbee or seen somebody playing with a frisbee. A frisbee is a circular airfoil. Basically, it's a flying wing. You get it to fly straight by getting it to spin. What Vesco points out is that the experiments on aircraft involving the sucked-in or blown boundary layer indicated that for a variety of very technical reasons, it was not expedient to have blown wings or suction wings on regularly shaped aircraft. However, if you took an aircraft which was all wing, that basically would be much, much more expeditious to use as a suction wing aircraft. And what Vesco develops, and I'm telescoping his argument here because it's very complex and takes a much longer section of text than I could read to you, he basically contends that what they did was they took a circular airfoil, which could be thought of as appearing to be something like a frisbee, and that they housed a turbine inside of it. Now, a turbine is what you see in the front of a jet engine, and I would recommend that people go down to either San Jose or SFO and take a look at a jet engine. What you'll see is a turbine, a multi-bladed propeller in the beginning of the engine. The way that a jet engine works, and a supercharger in a car works in a similar fashion, it sucks in the air, develops a tremendous suction of the air, so that you get a tremendous amount of oxygen mixed with the fuel mixture. When ignited, that produces an enormous explosion and creates the tremendous thrust that comes out of a jet engine, much greater and much more effective propellant than a propeller aircraft, in which basically a propeller propels an aircraft by chewing its way through the atmosphere. It actually takes a bite out of the air and pulls the plane through the air. With a jet engine, the turbine sucks a tremendous amount of air into the engine where it mixes with the fuel. When ignited, it produces an enormous explosion and a tremendous propulsive blast out the back of the jet. What Vesco contends is that an aircraft was developed, and again, it's very technical but very well documented. He contends that what they did was they took a circular airfoil. The top half of the aircraft, basically we could think of this as the top curved surface of the Frisbee, was made of sintered metal. The turbine, instead of being in the front of the jet engine and going around like this, was laid on its side and was inside of the aircraft, basically spinning in a direction that would be parallel to the ground. And that the intake of this jet engine, this modified sort of jet engine, was the entire surface of the aircraft. You have a tremendously powerful turbine, or perhaps a series of turbines, I can't say, and he does not specify, but inside of the aircraft, sucking in the boundary layer as fast as it is formed, so that the aircraft has no wind resistance. People know that things fly much faster in outer space than they do here on Earth. If there was no wind resistance, then an object flying through the Earth's atmosphere could, or no atmospheric resistance, I should say, could develop flight characteristics at least in some way similar to what we can generate in outer space, and things fly much faster in outer space.